Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is, of course, Monday, August 16th, 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria, and I want to give a shout out right here at the top, as I always do, to those of you who help make Talk Nerdy possible. Woo, that was fun. Each and every week, remember, Talk Nerdy is and always will be 100% free to download. That's because I do rely on the listener support of people just like you. The top supporters via Patreon this week include Mary Neva, Rob Schreck, Pasquale Gelati, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, Daniel Lang, David J. E. Smith, Dudas Infinitas, June Sapara, Ulrika Hagman, and Robert Chris. Thank you all so much for your support of the show. If you want to pledge your support, all you've got to do is visit patreon.com/talknerdy, or you can go to my website, carasantamaria.com, where you can shop in the Talk Nerdy store and support in all the ways that you can. All right, let's just dive right into this week's episode, because I had the incredible opportunity to have a chat with the ever-charming and so knowledgeable Ginny Smith. Now, Ginny's background is in psychology and neuroscience. She currently works as a science writer and presenter. She also founded Braintastic Science, which is this this really cool program that presents at schools, at festivals. They've been doing a lot of sort of like virtual stuff during the pandemic. And then she also teaches at the University of Cambridge's Institute of Continuing Education and works as a science communication trainer and consultant. And if that's not all, she hosts the British Psychological Society Psych Crunch podcast and is a regular presenter on the Cosmic Shambles Network. But she's here to talk about her new book. It's called Overloaded: How Every Aspect of Your Life is Influenced by Your Brain Chemicals. So here she is to talk neurochemistry. Without any further ado, Ginny Smith. Well, Ginny, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
I am super excited to continue this journey of talking about the brain. You know, just a couple of weeks ago now, I'm always time traveling when I record with my guests because it doesn't always match up exactly to the air date calendar. But I think as of the time this comes out, just a couple of weeks ago, we spoke on the show about computational neuroscience, which was heavily focused more on neurophysiology and sort of electricity and math. And now we're switching gears, not completely because there's so much crossover, to talk more about neurochemistry. So what are these actual little units of matter from the periodic table that help our brain cells communicate and ultimately are one of the things that's responsible for making us who we are? So first things first, before we even dive in, you know, your background is neuroscience and psychology. What specifically made you want to write a book about neurochemistry?
Well, I think it feels like over the last, I don't know, maybe 5 years or so, the kind of there have been more and more mention of some of these neurochemicals just sort of popping up in general life in the media. And it's sort of, it got me thinking, you know, there are these very simplified versions of serotonin makes you happy, dopamine is addictive, those kinds of things that you see in headlines and even in like pop songs and things now, they're being mentioned. And with my background in neuroscience, I knew that it was a bit more complicated than that. So I thought it would be really interesting to kind of dig into what we do know about these chemicals and what we don't know a little bit more and kind of pull out some of those nuances and see, well, are these simplified messages basically true, just simplified, or are they actually really misleading?
Oh, it's so important, right, to do the kind of difficult, sometimes nitty-gritty work of potentially debunking the situations in which, yes, I think science communication attempts to make something a little bit more understandable can sometimes go so far into deeming them incorrect, and then they can run, you know, pop psychology or blatant pseudoscience can then run away with these conceptions and often take advantage of consumers. You hear this a lot, as you mentioned, you know, dopamine, serotonin, noradrenaline, things like that. You hear it a lot, I find, with oxytocin. That one gets me.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's interesting the way people sort of latch on to one concept and one link that has been found and actually forget how complicated the brain is and that it's not just a case of one chemical always having the same effect. These chemicals can have completely different effects depending on where in the brain they're released, depending on what receptors there are in that area, even depending on the rate at which they're released. They can have all sorts of different effects. So, yeah, it was really, really interesting researching the book, but it turned out that it was even more complicated than I had realized when I started.
Absolutely. And I think it's such, you know, for me, from a personal perspective, because that's how I often treat this podcast. Sorry, listeners. I'm like, I hope you get something out of it too. But I'm really interested and curious in X, Y, and Z. And I think because I spent so much of my career studying neuroscience and then switched over to psychology. And these are salient concepts in both fields. But the farther I go into clinical psychology and specifically, you know, end of life psychotherapy, the farther I get away, I think, from, you know, being steeped into neurochemistry. Of course, it informs my work, but it's not my day to day. So I do feel like I've forgotten quite a bit. I probably haven't kept up with some of the more modern literature. And also even thinking back to the work that I did when I was doing my master's in neurobiology, my master's was very heavily focused on neurophys. Like I worked in a, you know, neurophysiology laboratory. We were doing a lot of electrical stimulation and reading these electrical readouts of these cells that were cultured in vitro. And so even though neurochemistry was an important part of it, it's actually very easy as a scientist to stay a little bit siloed and to sort of forget or maybe only have a very basic understanding of what your colleagues in almost the exact same field are doing, just they're studying a slightly different aspect. And of course, when it comes to the brain, there's a lot to know.
Totally. And I actually found that quite a lot when I was interviewing scientists for this book. And I'd be trying to get them to connect up either the kind of basic lab-based research with, well, how does that actually happen in the real world? Or the people doing the real kind of psychology of humans and how they behave and trying to connect that back into the neurophysiology. And it's really, really hard to do. And there aren't that many scientists doing that connection bit, which I found a little bit frustrating, because that for me is what's really interesting. Like, it's great to know what happens in a dish to some cells, but what I want to know is, well, what does that mean for me? And I think the problem is neuroscience is such a young field and the brain is so complicated that we need a few more decades of basic research before some of it is going to be able to be connected up. There were some bits that you can definitely see links through. But yeah, a lot of the time it is quite difficult to make those links between the lab work and the real world work.
And I think so often scientists are trained to be quite conservative in their communication approaches. And I don't mean politically conservative. I mean conservative in the sense that they don't want to overreach, right? So there's a lot of hedging. There's a lot of, well, our experiments only show this, so I can only speak to this. And what ends up unfortunately happening is that there's this whole murky world of interpretation that's often left to the journalists. And then, of course, scientists love to condemn the journalists and the science communicators for getting it wrong. Yet so often, and I've been on both sides of this equation, as have you, so often it's like, well, what do you expect when you're not willing to step in and say, no, I think it's probably safe to say that this is a potential outcome. But if we say that is a potential outcome, that's a real reach. That's not actually how it translates in the real world. So unfortunately, you end up with, I think, a fair amount of misinformation that is coming from the right place. And it's simply, you know, naive or it's misinterpreted. And then, of course, as I mentioned before, sometimes there can be nefarious actors who then take that information to try to sell you supplements or to try to, you know, make a buck on a consumer that's actually not based in evidence at all, or based in a kind of unrealistic interpretation of the evidence. So yeah, it's like, whose job is it then? And I think it's people like you, it's science communicators, people who sit down and do the dirty work to write the book. But then that's a lot of pressure on you to get it right, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I did sort of have to make my peace with the fact that probably by the time the book came out, something in it would be wrong or would have been changed, or a new paper would have come out that would have changed it. But I think one of the problems with what you're sort of talking about is that often journalists write based on a single study or a single press release, and they'll write this article being like, oh, this study has found this thing, this is amazing. But actually, that's not really how science works. Science is collecting hundreds of studies and going, okay, what is the most likely thing that's correct based on this huge wealth of evidence, not just one study shows one thing. So the problem with a lot of brain research is you can find studies saying almost opposing things. So what I had to do with this book was try and read as much as I could and kind of work out what is the consensus. I found 20 studies, including a few literature reviews and systematic reviews that say A, but then I've also found a few that say B, but it seems like the weight of evidence is leaning towards A. But then also kind of present that to the reader as, this isn't definitive truth. This is how science works, and this is our best understanding at the point that I wrote this book.
Yeah. I mean, and it's so much to keep up with, especially when we're talking about not just the totality of the human brain, but also within that, all of the different compounds, all of the different molecules that are utilized by the brain that have these different potential outcomes that we're still learning, you know, each of those about. I think back to Talk Nerdy now, I think I've been doing this for about 7 years. That sounds about right. And I've had, you know, a handful of people come on to talk about neuroscience. Of course, I'm a little bit have a bias towards that topic. So you know, if a new book comes out that seems interesting to me, I'll perk up a bit. And I know for a fact I can point to, like, I know that I've had, I think, a dopamine, like an entire dopamine episode for somebody who wrote a book about dopamine. I think I had a whole episode about birth control and about all of the different ways, yeah, that these kind of exogenous hormones can affect our endogenous body. Like, and crazy things that I didn't realize. Like, did you know that women on birth control have a blunted cortisol response? Just what? Like, that's important. And apparently the researcher, you know, the woman who wrote the book, she realized this because she was at a conference and they were talking about cortisol as a dependent variable in some study. And the doctor kind of just brushed off. He was like, oh yeah, well, we didn't use any women in the study. And she was like, why are there no women in your sample? And he was like, oh, because it's too hard to find ones that aren't on birth control. And as you know, birth control blunts their cortisol response. And she was like, as I know, like, what? How is this not more commonly known? And so, yeah, I know that I've talked specifically on the show about a couple of like, you know, drill deep, but this concept of all the neurohormones and neurochemicals, right? Because those are two different groups, and how they interact. This is big. So why don't we maybe, I don't know if I can be systematic about this. You had to be for the book, so you keep me honest.
Well, that's why I kind of went by topic, because I mean, just to sort of clarify, I don't cover all of the neurochemicals and neurohormones. I hardly even touch on reproductive hormones, just because there are hundreds of them. So what I had to do was I decided to go by topic. So each chapter is a kind of a thing that is important in our life. So whether that's learning and memory, whether it's mood, whether it's sleep. And then I sort of picked out what I thought were the most interesting or the biggest players when it came to chemicals involved in that topic, because I decided that was a better way of structuring it than trying to work through each chemical when one chemical can have so many different effects in different areas of life and of the brain.
Well, and I like how you did this from almost like a, I always mix these two up, but I think more of like a top-down approach as opposed to a bottom-up, which very often when we're reading our neuroscience textbooks, like those of us who are sort of steeped in the literature, it's like you start to notice patterns in how these things are presented, right? You might be learning about the neurochemistry first, and then you start to learn about these smaller pathways going into larger pathways. And you see things, learning and memory, for example, as you mentioned, that's such an important one. You're always going to learn about learning and memory. You're always going to learn about maybe mood, but you also get into things like, you know, logic or emotion. You're talking love, you're talking pain. Sometimes neuroscience textbooks are like, I'm not touching that. Like, I don't want to go there. It kind of goes back to that original thing of like, that might be too much of an interpretation, or I'm not comfortable saying anything about love. I'm going to leave that to the psychologist to figure it out.
Yeah. Well, as they say, my background was always in that. Well, my favorite bit when I was studying was that crossover between the two, the sort of cognitive neuroscience or behavioral psychology, or no, the other way around, behavioral neuroscience or cognitive psychology, that kind of crossover between the two. So that was, although the book is about neurochemistry, I wanted to make sure that every chapter had stuff about how that affects people's lives, because I mean, that's what we care about, right? When you're picking up a popular science book, yes, you want that information, but you also want to know, well, how does this affect me, particularly if it's a book about brains, because we've all got a brain and we all want to understand ourselves and other people better. So yeah, that was one of the kind of ideas for going from this topic-based approach. What are people interested in, and how do our neurochemicals affect that?
And how did you grapple with, or, and maybe you can even give us some examples of, like, what is the basic information that everyone needs to know? You know, how much in the weeds do we need to be about, this is a neuron, this is the functional unit, you know, these are how neurons communicate with each other, eventually enough neurons are communicating that it forms a circuit, you know, like, as you sort of talk about these building blocks, and you could get into the weeds, like I said, you could get deep into the periodic table if you wanted to, or you could keep it relatively simple and basic so that then you can spend more time talking about the bigger picture. What did you land on, and also how did you land on it?
I guess I was kind of thinking, how much background do people need in order to understand whatever the concept is that I'm talking about, in terms of whether it's learning a memory or love? So I do have an introduction chapter where we cover a little bit of the kind of those real basics of what is a neuron. Yes, they communicate using electricity, which is kind of what a lot of people think about if they know a little bit of neuroscience. We know that our brain uses electrical signals. But then the most important thing, if you're talking about neurotransmitters, is actually the gap between two neurons, which is called the synapse. So yes, we have an electrical signal. It travels along one neuron, but when it reaches the end, it has to get to the next neuron. And most places in the brain, that's done through chemicals. So the signal comes in, that first neuron releases chemicals. They travel across the little gap and are detected by the second neuron, which then sends its electrical signal. And the reason I think this is really interesting is that the electrical signals, they're all or nothing. Either they go or they don't go. And you can get changes in the networks of the brain, in the ways that those signals travel through neurons. But a lot of the time, if you're actually looking to change those neurons, that's quite a slow process. So for those kind of second by second changes that we all experience in our brain when we're thinking, when we're feeling something, when we make a decision, actually a lot of that happens at the synapse, because which chemicals are released, how quickly they're released, which receptors are there, things like that can change relatively quickly, very, very quickly for the chemicals that are released, and slightly slower for the receptors. But that, I think, is where a lot of this kind of stuff that makes us human happens, because that's where things can fluctuate and one area of the brain can influence another area of the brain, and how the connections are, how those signals are being sent through chemicals at this synapse. So it was very much a decision about how much do people need to know in order to get to the juicy stuff, to get to how does our learning and memory work, why do we fall in love, those kinds of things. So I didn't really break down the chemical components that make up each of the neurotransmitters, because actually, you don't need to know that. And I didn't go into exactly how the receptors trigger changes in the second cell once the chemical has bound to that, because these are these really long, complicated biomechanical, you know, cascades of different proteins and things. And actually, for what I was trying to explain, which is the effects that these chemicals have on our everyday lives, you don't need to know that. So yeah, so it was very much a decision at each point of what do you need to know in order to understand the good stuff, the juicy stuff.
No pun intended. I love that. And I think that's a, you know, it's such a solid approach, right? Because the truth is you do need to know what you introduced in order to, you know, understand the big picture. And also to, in order to understand, I think, the way that these things do affect our everyday lives. As you mentioned in the book, and as of course you focus on the book, there are these quote unquote normal, or maybe I should say neurotypical pathways that we see in learning and memory, that we see in, you know, everything from, you know, doing mathematical calculations to falling in love. Some of them are probably a little bit more systematic, like mathematical calculations. Falling in love may be a little bit less, you know, kind of specific. It may be, I don't know, subjective isn't quite the right word, but there may be more variability in something like that. But regardless, to know who we are based on our brain chemistry is also to know how we're different when our brain chemistry changes. And I think for me, that's one of the most salient personal experiences of our brain chemistry, is how we feel when we take a psychoactive drug. And almost everybody has some experience, whether it's having been diagnosed with a mental illness and taking something psychotropic that was prescribed by a psychiatrist, whether it was experimenting with drugs when you were young or maybe old, who knows, or whether it was, you know, going in for a surgery and needing to take something that, you know, ended up having a downstream effect, even if that wasn't its, you know, even if the purpose is not to give you like crazy dreams or to make you feel a little loopy, it's actually to numb pain or something. You may have these kind of these secondary bindings to some of these receptors. And to me, that's like, oh, now I see what it feels like to be beholden to my neurochemistry, because my whole life I've been living in this like very normative, neurotypical way, whatever that is that's real for me. And all of a sudden now I've taken a drug and I feel different.
Yeah. And actually, I was quite surprised. And I think a lot of people have been quite surprised reading the book, that a lot of the time we've worked the opposite way around to the way that you might expect, in that a drug has been discovered, it does something in the brain. We work out what the drug does, and then we go, oh, that must be why it's doing that thing. So a lot of the time, drugs haven't been developed specifically to target a particular chemical system in the brain. We've actually worked out about the chemical system based on the drug. So there's a lovely story in the book about the discovery of the opioid receptors, which were discovered by a lady called Candice Pert. And she actually started working on that after she had broken her back and spent a whole summer in the hospital taking lots and lots of opioid painkillers. And as a scientist, she came away from this experience being like, right, well, we know opioids reduce pain. So this is things like morphine, but also drugs like heroin. These are all opioid drugs. So we know the effect that they have on the body, but how are they having that effect? Why did they do that in the body? And she then set about finding the receptor, the place in the brain where opioids bind and how they have their effects. And that proved, or that kind of went on to suggest, that we must have natural versions of opioid molecules in our brain, because why we wouldn't have a receptor for something if it was not found in the brain, because that would be pointless. So actually, it was her experience of taking these drugs that sent her down that pathway, that meant that she discovered these opioid receptors.
Right. Yeah. And they actually were sort of named for this idea that they were endogenous opioids, as opposed to an opioid being an exogenous, you know, something we already had. And you see that a lot, even in the naming of these things, which is so cool. Of course, endogenous meaning something that we already, you know, that's in the body, and exogenous meaning something that's synthesized outside of the body that you take. And so, yeah, we do. We have endogenous opioids, which, of course, they're not opioids. I mean, they are opioids, but they existed long before we synthesized opioids. We just didn't know about them. That it's amazing. And you see that a lot with drugs, don't you? Because these kinds of binding affinities, these pathways, they're still not well known, because in order to know them means to open the brain. And in order to know them, it's unlike so many things in medicine where you can just take a blood test and see how much of some, you know, chemical is circulating in your blood. You can't do that with the brain. You can't see my dopamine levels. I can't test how good my serotonin is. We just have to kind of play around with different, you know, strengths and different formulations of antidepressants until we see which one works. And then maybe that helps us understand a little about how my brain is different.
Yeah. So antidepressants are a really interesting one, because everyone sort of accepted this idea that if you have depression, it's because you have low serotonin. But actually, the evidence for that is really indirect. And again, it often has come from how drugs affect the brain. So the first drugs that were discovered that had an effect on people's mood were discovered by accident. They were looking for drugs for other things, and they went, oh, hang on, this one makes people feel better. Let's try giving that to some people and see if it helps. And then scientists worked out what that drug was doing, and it was affecting a group of neurochemicals called monoamines, which includes serotonin, but also dopamine and noradrenaline. So then they went, oh, okay, well, if a drug that changes the levels of these chemicals impacts mood, that must mean that mood is impacted by your natural level of these chemicals, which you can see how the deduction works, but it's not necessarily a one-to-one relationship. And then SSRIs were developed, which are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and it was discovered that they had a really big impact on mood with less side effects than the others, because they're only influencing one chemical rather than influencing a bunch of them. So you're going to have less side effects. And so people latched onto, okay, well, if boosting serotonin helps improve people's mood when they have depression, that must mean depression is caused by low serotonin. And just to kind of explain what a reuptake inhibitor is, when the chemicals are released from the first neuron and they're traveling across that little gap, that synapse, and then being received by the second neuron, there's also a kind of what I like to think of as the Hoover or the vacuum cleaner of the synapse, which kind of sucks them back in and recycles them into the first synapse. So that means that the chemicals don't hang around for very long, which means that, you know, these signals can be sent quite quickly because the chemicals disappear and then you can release more. What a reuptake...
But that second cell, of course, then doesn't have access to it anymore.
Yes, exactly. So what a reuptake inhibitor does is it blocks that cleanup system. So you get more serotonin hanging around in the synapse for longer. The idea being that that then causes the signal to be sent more and somehow boosts your mood. So this is what's really led to the development of the serotonin hypothesis of depression, the idea that people with depression have low serotonin. But the problem is we don't really understand how SSRIs improve mood. Mm-hmm. We know that they do, but not in everyone. And we don't know why they don't work in everyone. And we also, there's this kind of weird bit of the puzzle, which is that SSRIs block reuptake within, I don't know, a couple of hours of taking them pretty quickly. But people don't start feeling better for about 6 weeks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this idea that if you don't have enough serotonin, we're going to give you something, it's going to raise your serotonin. Why is it taking you so long to feel better? So that was one of the things that I really explored in my chapter on mood. And I talked to a few different scientists who have different ideas as to what the serotonin is actually doing. And whether it is that people are deficient in serotonin or whether there's something else going on in their brain that these SSRIs are having an impact on that is then leading to them feeling better. And also kind of exploring whether there might be different forms of depression. And therefore, that's why some people respond to SSRIs and some people don't.
And some people respond to drugs in general and some people don't. For some people, you know, psychotherapy is enough. For some people, no matter how much psychotherapy they get, they need the drugs. For some people, you know, one drug or the first line drug isn't enough. So they might take, as you mentioned, a different formulation. So maybe instead of an SSRI, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, they'll take an SNRI, a selective serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, or maybe there's a dopamine component there. Or maybe they're treatment resistant across all of these types of drugs. And now we've got new things like ketamine or electromagnetic therapy, or even, you know, what we think of as kind of an older, more barbaric treatment, but of course it's done in a much more humane way right now, electroconvulsive therapy. And these things actually work for some people.
Yeah, they can. But what really shocked me was that we don't currently have any way of knowing which treatments will work for which people. So
it's all trial and error, isn't it?
If you are one of these people who turns out to be treatment resistant, it's probably taken 2 or 3 years of trying different drugs to get you to this point of, oh, no, you're treatment resistant.
Well, and in the United States, that's actually a requirement by insurance companies. They're not going to, your insurance insurer is not going to cover a ketamine trial until you've shown on paper, I tried this drug, it didn't work. I tried that drug, it didn't work. I tried that. So you're right. It can be years and years of sometimes pretty horrific side effects or just frustration with the fact that you're not getting better.
Yeah, and suffering from the depression as well. And that's a really long time to wait. So one of the scientists I talked to for the mood chapter was Catherine Harmer, who works at Oxford University. And she was one of the few who's trying to do that connection between, well, okay, this chemical is doing something in the brain. How is that changing people's experience of the world? And she has done some fascinating studies looking at brain activity of people after they have taken SSRIs, and also how it's changing the way they remember their experiences. So she was finding that after taking SSRIs, people who respond to SSRIs remember positive experiences better than they did before they took the SSRIs. So this is a kind of bias that we see in depression that, well, actually, it's more of a bias that we see in people who aren't depressed. So in the healthy population, we tend to remember positive things better than negative things. So if you give us a word list to learn, we will remember the positive words better than the negative ones. If you show us a bunch of faces, we'll spend more time looking at the happy ones and not looking at the sad or angry ones. People with depression show the opposite. So they spend more time looking at the bad things and they remember the bad things. But she found that even a single dose of SSRIs changed the way these people with depression were collecting information. And she was arguing that that might be why they work and also why they take a while to work. So they are changing the way you take in information immediately, but it takes a while for that to sort of trickle down into, oh, my life is better than I thought it was. But the thing that I found most interesting was that this change only happened in people who were going to respond to that drug.
Right. Okay.
So after one dose of it, she could predict who in 6 weeks' time was going to feel better and who wasn't going to respond to that particular drug they were trying. So I think that could be a huge breakthrough if we could bring that out of the lab and into clinical practice. If we could test people after a couple of days on a drug and say, okay, this one is going to work for you or this one isn't going to work for you, that could make a huge difference for patients.
Absolutely. And it sounds like a relatively simple assessment. It's a classic kind of, you know, psych test that you would give to university undergrads where you, you know, press the bar on the keyboard when you see a face that makes you feel X way and you look at reaction times and you may be able to synthesize data there to say, oh, this person is, you know, changing the way that they interact with stimuli based on their, based on the drug that they took.
She did do some brain scanning as well and saw differences in the way their amygdalas responded. So that's a part of the brain that's involved in emotion. But yes, it, at that, doing a brain scan on someone is very expensive, but giving them a memory test is not. So I think that that's some really exciting work, and I'm hopeful for that for the future.
Oh, I'm fascinated by this. And not to perseverate too much on mood, but of course, again, because I'm like being quite selfish and I'm like, this is my show. I'm going to ask you about things that are interesting to me. You know, as somebody who personally has been taking SSRIs now for probably about 10 years, and I've only recently started to kind of play, quote unquote, with my prescription, I can anecdotally attest to how bananas a positive reaction on a psychotropic medication versus a negative reaction on a psychotropic medication can feel. I remember when I first decided to try to take, you know, my depression was getting bad enough that I was like, I've been very resistant to medical treatment. I want to finally try. And I was in a pretty bad way. So the psychiatrist I worked with kind of decided, let's throw the book at it. And they gave me a complicated drug, a drug that had like a serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine component to it. And I felt like I was on meth. Like I took this drug and I couldn't sleep for days. And I had that classic suicidal reaction, which is quite scary. And a lot of psychiatrists even, I don't know how seriously they take it because they're like, I don't know if it just means the drug's not working. And so then the person feels suicidal. It's like, no, I've never in my life felt that way. I only felt that way after I took this drug. And we immediately stopped it. We went backward to a very clean and very classic SSRI. And it was like night and day. And I had the kind of response that you hear from a lot of people who have started taking drugs and who have found a drug that works for them, which is, why did I wait so long? I could have been feeling like this for years and years. This is probably what it feels like to feel, to not have the, you know, the cloak of depression hanging over me. And so it's interesting because when I talk to my psychiatrist now, and we're starting to try and play around because I'm dealing with some side effects like fatigue. And she's like, well, what about this drug? Or you'd be great for, you know, Wellbutrin or these other things that have this dopamine component. And I'm like, no. I know what I feel like when I take uppers. I know what I feel like if I have more than one cup of coffee in a day. Like I know my body's response to norepinephrine, to these different things. And I think knowing thyself, knowing how your brain works and starting to calculate for yourself these experiences of, you know, when I take these drugs, I get these kinds of side effects. When I'm on these drugs, I feel less like this or more like this, can really help for patient advocacy when you find yourself in these scenarios where your doctor is trying to work with you, not for you, in order to find the right outcome for you. It can help you have a voice, which I think is so incredibly important in these experiences.
Yeah, definitely. And I think one of the things that makes studying brains so difficult is that they are all different. Our brains they're built based on our DNA, which is different to start with, but then they're constantly changed and shaped by our experiences all throughout our lives, particularly when we're sort of children, but even later in life as well. They're constantly changing. So just because something works for one person, it doesn't necessarily work for another. And things might start or stop working for you at some point in your life as you change, your brain changes, your body chemistry changes. I think caffeine is a really great example. Like, we all know people who can drink 6 cups of coffee a day, including one after dinner, and still fall asleep really easily. And then we all know people who, if like me, if I have a cup at 3 p.m., I'm awake all night. And like differences like that, even if you haven't taken, you know, more stronger drugs, caffeine is a drug, and pretty much everyone has tried that. And we know that some people get anxious and jittery and some people don't. And why that is, yeah, it makes studying the brain a whole lot harder. I think pretty much every heart is pretty much the same, but every brain is like completely different. So it does make it, yeah, a lot more challenging. But I think, as you say, it's really useful to get to know yourself and know what works for you and what doesn't work for you, and whether that is behavioral changes that can have knock-on effects on brain chemistry, or whether it is external drugs or other kind of things, whether that's caffeine or over-the-counter painkillers, or whether we're talking about prescription drugs, working out what works for you is a very important part of understanding yourself.
Absolutely. And I feel like at this point, just because of the work that I do in psychotherapy with patients, so I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm training to be a clinical psychologist, so I don't have prescriptive authority, but I work in a cancer center where all of my patients take a lot of medication. And unlike chemotherapies, or unlike certain drugs that they have to take to maintain their to keep their tumor markers down, or drugs that they take to maintain their blood pressure, or to, you know, prevent infection, drugs that keep them alive. When we talk about psychotropic medication, and also, you know, other types of medication, like you mentioned, even caffeine, I think, I don't know who needs to hear this right now, but I feel like this is a good time to say it. Only you know yourself, and you're the captain of your ship. And so I think we've long had a very paternalistic medical system, and it's starting to come around to the idea of patient advocacy and patients' voices. But for so long, we've been taught that if doc says it's right, I should just suffer the consequences. But the truth is, if you're especially your psychiatrist, but really any physician, prescribes a drug and you don't feel well on it, you don't feel good, you don't feel right, say something. Get to the bottom of it with your doctor and figure out what you guys can do together to feel good and to feel right, because you're not supposed to feel bad. And I think so often we don't know that, we don't realize that, so we suffer through feeling bad in the hopes that we're going to feel good later. And I think this is a really sad, sad negative outcome of brain chemistry treatment. And so I don't know who needs to hear that right now, but you have a voice. Your voice is important. Don't just stop taking it without telling your doctor, but do call your doctor and say, this doesn't feel right. It's such an important thing to do, is to advocate for yourself. Anyway, moving on beyond that, sorry to get off my soapbox. We've talked a lot about mood, because I do think mood is very relevant, right? It's relevant to people. So many people struggle with mental illness,
and even if you don't. Particularly at the moment.
Right, yes, because of the pandemic. Oh, God. And whether you do or you don't, you know somebody who does, and you know somebody who's grappling with this. So, of course, I think it's a really salient component. But you talk about a lot of other things in your book as well, not just mood. And so we've focused a lot on dopamine, on serotonin, on norepinephrine. We even talked a little bit about caffeine, because yes, caffeine does affect one's mood. It's known to affect one's mood. But you talk about other things that I think are so interesting. We mentioned love. Love is complicated. We mentioned, you talk about motivation. You talk about fear response. We talk about sleep. Oh my gosh. Can we talk a little bit about sleep? I mean, something that's so relevant right now. Everybody's sleep is completely screwed.
Yeah, it's interesting. Apart from my husband's, he can sleep anywhere, anytime. And I talk about, this was actually kind of one of the inspirations for this chapter. It's sort of like, why can he sleep anywhere, anytime, even after drinking coffee? And I have to coax my body and be in the perfect, you know, everything has to be perfectly dark and quiet and cool. And yeah. Why?
Because
why
the world is not fair, Ginny. Not
fair. Although it is very beneficial, because if we were both light sleepers, I think we'd both keep each other awake all night. So I'm very grateful that he's such a good sleeper. But yeah, it's interesting. A lot of people are finding at the moment, I guess, with the stress of the pandemic, but also the kind of loss of their normal routine. I think that's one thing that's having a big impact on people's sleep, because there are a few different ways that our brain knows that it's time to sleep. And one of them is very simply how long we've been awake. And that's detected by the buildup of a chemical called adenosine in a particular part of the brain. And it's basically produced when your awake brain cells are doing their thing. They produce this adenosine chemical as a side effect, sort of waste product. So then the brain can use that to know how long you've been awake, because more adenosine means your brain's been awake for longer. So the more adenosine you have in this part of your brain, the sleepier you feel. And that's actually what caffeine effects. So caffeine binds to the receptors that normally detect adenosine and tricks your brain into thinking there's less of it than there actually is. And that's why it can make you feel a bit more alert. So then, so that's one way that our brain knows that it's time to sleep because you've been awake for a long time. But then we also have a body clock or a circadian rhythm, which kind of keeps you in phase with day and night. And that's driven by a chemical called melatonin, which is released in the evening when it's starting to get dark and tells you that it's coming towards nighttime and you should start to feel sleepy. But our body's body clock isn't perfect. It isn't exactly 24 hours. And that's really useful because it means that we can move our body clock, which is what we do when we travel and we go to a different time zone. And jet lag is the experience of your body clock not matching up with your new time zone. But it does gradually get there. And the way it gets there is through light exposure. So when you get bright light in the morning, that tells your brain that it's morning and that delays the release of melatonin. And then your body sort of calculates how many hours it's been since you got that bright light to work out when to release the melatonin. So I think one of the problems a lot of people are having at the moment is that we're working from home, a lot of us, and we're maybe not able to get that bright light in the morning that is setting our body clock. Your brain can also set your body clock based on routine. So I interviewed a colleague who has worked on ships in the polar circles, so where there's no change in light throughout the day. She had 24-hour daylight for a few weeks while she was doing some research. And she was saying that you set your body clock based on other things. So it's based on when you eat, and it's based on when you work, and it's based on when you socialize. And if you keep those as proper rhythms, your brain can actually use that, despite the fact that there's no change in the light, to keep you on a 24-hour cycle. So with everyone's routines being completely messed up at the moment, and you're not doing that, your usual commute to work, sit in the office for however many hours, commute home, have dinner, you know, it's not quite the same. I think that's one of the reasons some people are finding issues with their sleep.
That's interesting. And we can also do not just these, like you mentioned, routinized kind of signals for our body to know this is sort of the crescendo of the day. This is the day crescendo of the day. But also, we can actually affect, and we do because of the electric light bulb, we affect our day-night cycles, our circadian cycles, based on light. And this is why there's a lot of pretty good evidence to support the idea that having a bright light that emulates the same color temperature of the sun in your office can be very beneficial for both your mood, but also your alertness. It's why you shouldn't pop a melatonin at night and then look at your phone for 2 hours. You need it to be in the dark. That's the whole point, right? Like, the dark is, as soon as you have light, it's just going to counteract the melatonin that you've taken. And so, yeah, we can do things. We can sleep with blackout curtains, or we can put an eye mask on our eyes late at night, which can help us kind of, even though, you know, I live in Los Angeles, it is bright out my window at night. So I have blackout shades, and it really does make a massive difference in the quality of my sleep to be able to open my blinds early in the day. And close out the city lights at night in order to sort of induce a more natural day-night cycle for myself.
Yeah, exactly. So these daylight lamps are great, but you want to only be using them in the morning. So you want a couple of hours in the morning, tell your brain it's morning, lots of nice light, and then go to sort of normal lighting throughout the day. And then maybe a couple of hours before bed, you want to start dimming everything. And there is some evidence that blue tinged light might be more effective at delaying melatonin, so worse for you in the evening. So a lot of people are now using blue light filters on their phones, and some people even wearing blue light glasses. it seems like bright is probably the most important thing, and then blue is next. So dim everything as much as possible is the kind of most important thing. And then if you want to turn your screen a bit more yellow, that might help as well. But yeah, making sure everything is dim, and also just taking some time away from the screen in terms of not working all the way through to bedtime. And I think with more people working from home, more people are perhaps finding it. I've been freelance pretty much my whole working life, so I've always worked from home. But I know a lot of people are finding that no longer having that distinction between work time and home time means that they're just working later. And then, you know, if you work till 10 p.m. and then go to bed, you're not going to fall asleep right away. Your brain needs some time to kind of wind down and tell itself that it's no longer got to go and got to think. So yeah, a couple of hours with dimmed lights, doing something where you're not thinking about work, I think is hugely valuable before bed.
Yeah, it's probably the most important thing you could do. And for people who simply aren't in a position to be able to do that, right? Because of course, it's a privileged position to be able to do that. There are alternatives. I remember doing I did a whole collaboration with the Natural History Museum here in Los Angeles about night shift workers and about kind of the city at night and nocturnal animals. It was a really cool program that they put on. And we did a panel, and there was a researcher on the panel who had been... he actually wasn't involved with the company, but he highly recommended to me this software for my computer. And there's all sorts of different, you know, softwares that do this, but this one was called Flux, and I've been using it since then. And it's so cool because it gradually dims and shifts the color temperature. You tell it what time you go to bed and what time you wake up. And in the morning, it blasts you with bright light that's more like the sun. And then as the day goes on, as you mentioned, it tries to emulate what your room lighting would look like. And then at night, it starts to dim. And sometimes I don't realize I'm up, you know, I'm working on my dissertation. I'm like up late typing and it's been hours and I haven't even gotten up to pee. And I finally do. And I'm like, ooh, my computer's dim. So I might turn my Flux off. And I'm like, holy crap. It goes from being like red to being so bright and blue. And I don't even realize the difference because it happens so gradually. So I'm grateful that there are technologies like this that exist, where at least we're trying to utilize some of the science and in a way that is meaningful and actually can help positively impact our lives. Then again, of course, sometimes all this stuff can be taken too far and it's no longer based on evidence. It's based on what we hope or we think the evidence shows. And that's where we kind of get in trouble, because of course, consumer products are often say, you know, it's based in science, but then we made it better.
Yes. Yeah. People do tend to take a nugget of real information and then extrapolate into all these different products. I think the other advice I've heard for shift workers is if you finish a shift in the morning and you have to go outside to get home, which most do, is wear sunglasses. Wear the darkest sunglasses you can find, maybe wear a hat. You trying to avoid getting too much of that light to your eyes if you're going to go home and try to sleep. Because if you've come out of a long shift and blasted your brain with sunlight, your brain's going to go, oh, it's morning. And then you're going to find it harder to get to sleep when you get home. So trying to keep yourself in the dim as much as possible can be quite helpful.
And at home, using that, it's so tough. I mean, and I think it's a daily struggle, you know, to kind of normalize to that, especially because the world is operating on a different schedule, which means if you want to do anything normative, go to your kid's baseball game, you have to break your schedule. But yeah, dim lights, like you said, amber lights, even just candles. Like late at night, I try not to use my overhead lights and I mostly use candles to see. It helps me go to sleep so much faster. Yeah, I think that's the way we used to do it, right? Back in the day, before we had light bulbs.
The sun would turn off and we'd light a
exactly.
fire.
Yeah, exactly. All we could do. And for a very long time, we evolved with that as our signal. You know, it's only recently that we've evolved with overhead lights as our signal. And so in our brain does, you know, it's interesting, all of these different neurochemicals that you dive into and how they work and how they affect us and ultimately what we do know and what we really don't know. It comes down to a sort of co-evolution. You know, we are mammals that exist in a world with sophisticated brains, yes, but still mammalian brains. And we evolved in a landscape. And we've also developed now a landscape that is not the landscape that for 250,000 years as human beings we were evolving in. And I think sometimes we have these disconnects. And I know it's a pretty far stretch from a conversation about neurochemistry, but the truth is this dopamine, this norepinephrine, this serotonin, this, give me some more, this GABA, this glutamate.
Glutamate and GABA always get missed out, and they're probably the most abundant.
I know that these things evolved with us on this planet, on a landscape with certain, you know, stimuli like the sun setting and the food that we eat and our intersubjective interactions with other people and with other animals and with plants and things like that. And now we live in a modern world full of technology. And sometimes these things, they don't fit very well. And we have to sort of make them work. But we're doing it. I think we're doing it with good medicine. We're doing it with really good research. And we're doing it with really good science communication so that we can better know ourselves and become better advocates for healthcare, for our own healthcare, better advocates for our own lives. Ultimately, I'm curious, Ginny, like, what do you hope that people get out of learning about their own brain chemistry? Like, what is your hope as you finished the book, as you saw the book go to print? What an exciting experience, you know, and you felt the cover of the book in your hands. What were your hopes and dreams about, you know, how will this affect people? Why does it matter?
So I think one of the things is one thing you mentioned a little bit earlier, which is just having a little bit more, just taking a step back when people see headlines saying something about one particular chemical doing something. And then even more importantly, when people are trying to sell them something that claims to be, you know, the perfect diet to change this in your brain, or the you know, our testing can balance your neurohormones, or, you know, all of that sort of rubbish that you see out there, to just have that little bit more background information so they can read it and go, well, that's interesting, but I know that it's a little bit more complicated than that. So anything that is oversimplifying, particularly to try and sell you something, just take it with a bit of a pinch of salt. So I think that was kind of one of my aims. Another is just to kind of, I find the brain incredible. It's so complicated and so intricate. And I just find that amazing. And I think people deserve the chance to be shown some of that complexity. And you can't do that in an article. So I totally understand. And I've written articles and you have to simplify. But the lovely thing about writing a book, it felt quite indulgent, actually, as a writer, that I could go into some of these nuances and I could explain that there are a few different theories for this. And this one is good from this angle, but it also, maybe this one is better from this angle. And just having the space to give people a real taste of what science is really like, that it is conflicting evidence and trying to piece together these kind of different elements of the puzzle and trying to build up a picture of what things might be doing. And giving people the kind of respect to tell them all of that rather than thinking they need it to be simplified into one sentence so that they can understand it. I think people who read popular science are ready for a little bit more nuance. So yeah, I hope people come away with respect for their brains, for how amazing it is that they don't go wrong more often, considering how complicated they are, and just kind of a bit more curiosity about all of these different topics. I mean, I've got 9 chapters, I think, and you could easily have written a book on each of those. And there have been books written on each of them. So I also hope that if anyone finds one of the chapters particularly interesting, they go away and dig into that a little bit more. And it just kind of ignites their curiosity about their brain.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, because it is the literal embodiment of the word awesome. Not the way we use the word usually, but brains are literally awesome. Like, there is so much awe in introspecting and thinking about this incredible wetware that we have that makes that introspection possible. I mean, it's the reason that so many people like you, like me, and like so many others out there decided that that's what we wanted to study when we had the opportunity and the privilege to attend university. And I think it's also one of those things that it's sort of like cosmology and neuroscience. You kind of can't go wrong. There's always something fascinating for everybody. And you really encapsulated that in your book.
I think I also... The scientists that I cover in the book, both the ones that I talk to and the ones who I kind of dug into the history of how some of these chemicals were discovered, and also read hundreds of papers and stuff. But I ended up with so much respect for these scientists, because it wasn't just once, but multiple times you'd be reading a biography of the scientist who discovered a particular chemical, and it would turn out they'd worked on it for 60 years, or like one of the first genetics studies in one of these areas, it took them 40 years to do what we can now do in half an hour with one of the kind of new technologies to isolate a gene. So I think I also tried to go into a bit more of the kind of how science is done and how it builds on different people's work in the past. So yeah, I came away with even more respect for scientists and just their patience and their tenacity. So yeah, giving people a little bit more of a glimpse into what scientists do as well was another thing that I was quite keen to do.
And I'm so glad you did. I'm definitely a firm believer in the fact that the process of science is almost... sometimes it's a given it's due, other times it's not, but I think that it should be inextricably linked to stories about science, right? It's so fundamental to understand the people and the process that we need to be telling that story over and over and over and over and over and over again. And so I'm glad that you did. You kind of wove that into the narrative, because without it, you know, I think our critical thinking skills will languish. We have to constantly be reminded of how none of this came easy. We don't just know it by snapping our fingers. We have the privilege to know it by reading a line in a book, but that line represents, as you mentioned, sometimes, centuries, but at least for certain people, decades of a career, in order for us to be able to say unequivocally, X plus B equals C. And so, you know, to take that for granted, which we so often do, I think really is a travesty. So when we're reminded, it's so important. So Ginny, I told you we were going to talk for 45 minutes. It's been 58. I'm looking at, about to be 59. So I do want to let you go. But before we go, I always close my show by asking my guests the same two questions. And I'm going to be fascinated in your responses, especially as somebody who has been working as a science communicator for so long, has so many varied interests, but of course, might have neurochemistry on the brain. So you ready for these big questions? Okay, so thinking about the future, and that's the key word, the future, in whatever context is relevant to you. So it could be informed by the work that you've recently done, or it could be, you know, informed by your personal life, or something that none of us have are privy to. I want you to tell us first, what is the thing that's keeping you up the most at night, making you the most concerned, the most worried, maybe even pessimistic? But then on the flip side of that, you know, where are you finding your optimism? What are you kind of genuinely hopeful for?
Okay, so I guess... Ooh, those are big questions, aren't they?
Right. Yeah, you can take a minute.
I know I said I listened to a couple of other podcasts, but I don't think I got right to the end because I didn't hear anyone else's answers to those.
There are themes, just so you know. I often hear there are some answers that are really thematic, and then every so often I'm like, I've never heard that answer.
Okay, so I think one of the things that is I think a worry at the moment and moving forwards is the kind of false news thing. I've actually been doing a lot of reading recently into how to effectively debunk myths, because there is some concern. We know that our brains think things are more likely to be true if we hear them more often. So there has been some concern that if you are constantly debunking a myth, by telling people that this particular thing is a myth, that might actually reinforce it. Because what they remember is, oh, I heard Ginny Smith talking about left brains and right brains. And that just gets filed under, I heard about left brain and right brain again. So you might actually risk reinforcing a myth when you're trying to debunk it. But I actually found some really interesting research which has broken down the best way to debunk myths. I think it's a big concern at the moment, particularly with things like the anti-vaccine movement. We've all seen sort of stories of people who've had what they think are bad side effects from a vaccine. And it tends to be the people who have had negative experiences who speak out, whereas all the people who were fine after a vaccine aren't writing articles about it and posting it on social media. So it can be very easy for our brains to think that this thing happens more often than it actually does.
Yeah, so why we always say we have to consider the hits and not just the misses, or vice versa. Yeah, because there's that bias that comes out from only noticing the bad Yelp reviews.
We get it with, I think it's shark attacks and plane crashes that they've done studies on as well. We think that they are both much more common than they are, because pretty much every time one happens, it's reported on. Whereas we don't get newspaper reviews about so-and-so went swimming and didn't get eaten by a shark. Like, you don't see them. So I think with social media and with the kind of all those sites that don't fact check things and just repost things, I think that is a big concern for the future. And I think what makes me hopeful is that we have the opportunity to help the next generation learn how to assess sources. And I think actually that has to become one of the most important jobs that we do as science communicators, but also for teachers and for parents, is to give kids the tools to read something and see, well, is this a credible source? What about the content of it? Have they simplified something so much that it's unlikely to be true? Have they told me what their sources are? Where is this information coming from? And giving people that kind of the ability to think critically, I think, is where we're going to really make a difference on this. And also teaching people how to debunk things properly, which is to not leave people with a hole in their knowledge. So just telling someone that there is no such thing as a left-brained person and a right-brained person, that's not particularly helpful, because what you've done is you've now given them a hole in their knowledge, and there's nothing to fill it with, and our brains don't like gaps. So what you have to do to debunk is to say, we do have some understanding that certain abilities are found on one side of the brain or the other. So most right-handed people have their language abilities on the right-hand side of the brain. But brain scans have shown that people don't have a left or right-brained bias. So there's actually a study that looked at resting state brain scans. So people who were just put in a brain scanner and told to relax. And they found that everyone was using both sides of their brain all the time. So there's no evidence at all that people prioritize using one side of the brain over the other. We do have different abilities. We do have different personalities, but the link with sides of the brain just isn't there. So giving people something to plug the gap with is really important when trying to counter this kind of misinformation that's so prevalent out there.
Absolutely agree. I think it's so important to hear about science communicators doing their due diligence to understand the science of science communication, so that you can then utilize this kind of knowledge. Like, the more that, you know, we can learn about how people, you know what they know, or why people believe the things that they believe, how to counteract sort of propaganda and, you know, all of the things that you mentioned, it then arms us with better skills when we set out to do the work that we do, which I think is so incredibly important. And of course, then, you know, not keeping that all stuck behind a curtain, like it's some sort of thing that only we are privy to, but sharing these things with everybody, because Everyone is a science communicator, or can be if they want to be. Everyone has someone in their life who falls victim very readily to propaganda, to pseudoscience. How could we not? There's an orchestrated campaign in many cases in order to convince people of things that aren't true, because there's a moneyed interest in it. And so if we are armed with critical thinking skills, and not because it's not just about having the critical thinking skills, then we also have to have the communication skills to explain to, you know, our family member, our friend, our colleague, our whatever, and engage with them in a respectful kind of way, the world will be better for that.
Definitely. And I think one of the things that gives me real hope is when I go into schools and events and I'm working with young kids, particularly that sort of 7 to 11 age group. And a number of times I've heard one of the kids after an event talking to maybe a parent or a friend who wasn't there later at the festival and telling that friend or that parent something that I told them in the show. And that is just one of the best feelings I ever get as a science communicator, hearing someone go, oh, I learned this really cool thing about my brain and I want to show you how to do this illusion or whatever.
And
and the questions kids ask me after shows. I love doing Q&A, and kids are so curious about everything, but particularly about their brains, I think, or maybe that's just what I've experienced. And I think we have to nurture that curiosity and not think that it's only for kids. Think that curiosity is something that we can retain as adults, and that it's okay to say you don't know something and then go out and look for that answer. And that should be celebrated, not, oh, you don't know that thing. That shouldn't be a bad thing to admit. It should be a good thing, and it should ignite your curiosity to go and find out more.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you very humbly were just referencing Braintastic Science. And of course, I mentioned this in the intro, but we didn't really have time to talk about it in the show. So maybe before we go, can you let everybody know where they can go to learn more about all of this great work that you do on top of your authoring, your writing?
Yeah, so Braintastic Science is my the stuff that I do for kids. So I do a lot of shows in schools and at science festivals, or at least pre-COVID. Recently, we've done virtual shows, which is great because I can now work with kids kind of anywhere in the world, which is really lovely. But we also do kind of lesson plans and workshops, and we have a kind of a science club thing, which is all on demand, all about the senses, where families can just sign up and then you get 6 weeks of videos and activities. It's all really hands-on, and it's all aimed at getting kids kind of interested and excited about neuroscience, because it's not really something that is taught very much in schools. And I think everyone can benefit a bit from learning a little bit about how their brains work. So the website is braintasticscience.com.
Love it, love it, love it. Well, Ginny, thank you so much for taking the time, even a little bit of extra time, to share your wisdom with us, to get us excited, re-excited and reacquainted with our brains. I learned an awful lot, and I had a great time chatting with you.
Thank you for having me. It's lovely. Been lovely. Thank you.
Absolutely. And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.